Hi, welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm reporter Joaquin Sapien, and today I have on the program Daily News reporter Sarah Riley. Riley has teamed up with ProPublica to produce a series of stories on abuse in the New York Police Department's enforcement of nuisance abatement laws. The laws are supposed to give city officials authority to curb illegal activity by shuttering locations where it occurs. But Riley found that over the last several years, police have frequently moved to evict people from their apartments or their businesses based on dramatically flawed evidence. In dozens of cases, residents and small business owners have been cleared of crimes but deemed a nuisance and removed nonetheless. Most of those targeted are minorities, while people living or working in white communities seem to have been mostly spared. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I've got to say, sort of up front, nuisance abatement doesn't sound like the most enticing topic to really explore. I think of rowdy college kids getting kicked out of their dorms or drug dealers being scrutinized by police. How did you decide that you were going to look into this, and what did you find early on that told you there was a story here worthy of deeper exploration?
So I first came across this story when I was working on another project a few years ago on police misconduct lawsuits. And just reading through the lawsuits, there was one case that was over a wrongful arrest. And in the suit, the plaintiff had mentioned that even though her charges were quickly dismissed, the city tried to evict her from her home. And so that kind of jumped out at me. I wanted to find out what type of case that was, and obviously, you know, wondered if it was an anomaly, if it was systemic that the police were seeking to remove people from their homes who had been exonerated of the crimes against them. I didn't know that it was a nuisance abatement case that she was referring to. This was a wrongful arrest suit. But after speaking with some attorneys, learned that what type of case it was, a nuisance abatement case. And then also the building that she lived in, there were actually four other apartments in that same building that also received nuisance abatement cases on the same day. I learned, you know, from speaking with the attorney, and then another reporter had spoken to some people in the building and, you know, kind of pieced it together. So you had five cases in one building over raids that were carried out by the same officer, the most sued officer on the force, all on the same day. 13 arrests were made. One dog was shot dead. So there's a huge amount of fallout over this raid. Resulted in only one conviction for a misdemeanor marijuana offense, and yet all five apartments received these nuisance abatement actions seeking to close down the apartment for a year unless they, you know, signed a settlement. From that, I could see that there was definitely the potential for a story, but I wanted to broaden it beyond just, you know, the work of that one detective that we were already focusing on as the most sued officer on the force, and determine if it was more systemic than that. And so I think that the moment that I realized that it was a much bigger story was after we had gone through so many cases, more than 1,000, we had pulled out all the people that we could find who had either been excluded or who gave up their tenancy in order to settle the action. And then we put out a request for the disposition of the criminal cases and the underlying criminal case that the actions were based on. Once I got back all those dispositions and put them all into a spreadsheet and then ran the query and saw that less than half of the people who had either been excluded or who had gave up their tenancy were actually convicted of a crime, and many of them weren't even arrested, I definitely knew it was a bigger story at that point.
Right. So just to pause for a moment, you do all this grueling work, you get a ton of dispositions, you enter them into a spreadsheet, it's probably sort of mind-numbing, and then you enter this query and you find out that, you know, over half of the people who hadn't been convicted of a crime but were still served these abatement actions. So what's that feel like?
Well, I think that was the first big wow moment. To clarify, we only sought the dispositions of the people who were excluded from a home or who had to give up their leases. We didn't seek the dispositions of the other people who had been served with the cases. Just those dispositions on their own was a lot of work.
Right. I see. So yeah. Only so, the most serious cases, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Even then, you know, fewer than half of the people were convicted of a crime, and there were a lot of people who weren't arrested. And so you could only imagine the people that, you know, didn't end up getting excluded from their homes. But yeah.
So something else that struck me as probably a key breakthrough moment was speaking to the attorney who wrote this law in the 1970s, mm-hmm. Sidney Baumgarten, who was doing it to address a pretty thriving sex industry in Times Square, if I understand it correctly. Mm-hmm. And now, decades later, come to find out it's being applied in a completely different way. And he says to you, it's being abused.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Take me through kind of meeting him for the first time and listening to this guy who wrote the law saying that his law is now being unjustly applied.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be honest, I sort of had an indication of what he was going to say when I interviewed him because I had found an article by Gay City News that talked about the way that the city was using this law against gay bookstores. And he was actually quoted in that piece saying something similar. So, you know, just that he felt that it was being abused today. He wasn't aware of how the law was being used against families. That part of it hasn't really been reported. And, I think that he was pretty shocked at that point. But
so you also spoke with Robert Messner, the head of NYPD's Civil Enforcement Unit, and he seemed pretty defensive of the program. But I thought he used sort of a flawed logic, you know, saying that nuisance abatement is about places, not people, almost as though people aren't living in these places. What were your conversations with him like?
Well, I would say, first of all, that I was very shocked that he said that during an on-the-record interview. I think that it came off as a little callous, given how severely people are impacted when they lose their homes. But anyway, so it was a long process to set up the interview. I actually ended up doing two interviews with them. I probably had to send dozens of emails, make dozens of calls. Finally, I cornered an official at a different event and finally got it set up. They're definitely, you know, defensive of the program. Robert Messner started the program in the 1990s and 1991. So this has kind of been his baby for, you know, decades. So they were definitely defensive.
You observed some court proceedings in Queens, and there were many people coming in and out who were at risk of losing their homes. And it seemed like a lot of folks didn't really understand what exactly was happening in the courtroom. Talk about that. Take us into that courtroom.
Yeah. I'll preface that by saying that before I went to court, I had talked to a lot of people on the phone and asked them to describe how the court proceedings went. And another really shocking moment for me was when over and over again people said, you know, that the judge was never in the room, that the attorney pulled them out into the hallway. I think, you know, five or six people mistakenly referred to the NYPD's attorney as their court-appointed attorney or the attorney that the court provided to me or the attorney who was there to help me.
So people thought that the city's attorney, which is pursuing an action in mm-hmm. which they might be taking away a person's home, those folks actually thought that that attorney was representing them?
Yes.
How could that confusion happen?
Well, I think that these types of actions tend to target people who don't have the level of education that you or I may have. They're not as savvy about court proceedings. I will say that when I did go to court and sat there, it was like a fly on the wall. The NYPD's attorney was very friendly when he approached the defendant. So I can see how maybe, depending on how the attorney was, you know, speaking to the defendant, speaking to the tenant, there might be some confusion there. I overheard some of the conversations, and they were being done in a very kind of like friendly way, almost like giving advice. So I could see in that sense, why there might be some confusion. So when I went to court, though, it basically just confirmed what I had been hearing on the phone, which was pretty shocking to me. And then to get to court and to see that the judge on both days never once entered the room was pretty surprising to me, too.
Tell me about some of the people that you met in court. You wrote about a 90-year-old woman mm-hmm. whose son may have been stashing drugs in her apartment,
mm-hmm.
and she was at risk of losing her home, but didn't really understand, it sounded like,
yeah,
what was going on.
Yeah. Lily Capers had come into court with her daughter-in-law. She actually owned her home, and the police had found drugs at the home and arrested the son. He was already living in a treatment program in the Bronx, and she lives in Queens, so, you know, pretty far away. At the time that the NYPD served an order on her, they actually had an order to temporarily close her home pending the outcome of the case. But when they came and found that it was just an elderly woman living there, they did allow her to stay in the home. So I was there for her first court date. She was with her, as I said, daughter-in-law, who was maybe in her 40s. While we were waiting for the NYPD attorney to call them over, I asked if I could see their stipulation. And that's what the document is called. Also, some people know it as a settlement, but it says, you know, stipulation on the front of the document. And they didn't know what I was referring to. Then they got called out into the hallway to speak with NYPD's attorney. And when they came back, I asked them, you know, what they decided. And they said that they agreed to sign it. And I asked what the terms were, and they weren't really clear on what the terms of the stipulation were, only that it meant that Lily could stay in her home. So I asked to see the stipulation, and I was, you know, reading it, and I asked them if they were aware that the stipulation says that if her son was found at her home at any point within, I can't remember if it was a year or 2 years, that the NYPD could immediately shut down the home. And to me, that was, you know, pretty clear. Of course, I spent a lot of time reading court documents, but the language, you know, to me seemed clear, and they did not know that that's what the settlement said. I also asked them, this is something that a lot of people don't realize that they're signing, but in pretty much every settlement, there's an indemnification clause where the signer waives their right to sue the city for any damages either during the police investigation or during the closure of their home. And I asked them if they were aware that they could no longer sue the city for any damages over anything involving the investigation or the case, and they weren't aware of that either. So just going through some of the key components of the agreement, they did not know what they had agreed to.
Right. So this is kind of a moment that crystallizes and supports all that you had been told, or much of what you had been told up until that point, that people are signing away their rights without really understanding what they're signing, that they're not clear on who is representing them in court, and that the people presiding over these proceedings are largely absent. How'd you feel walking out of court that day, having discovered that what you'd been told up until that point was true?
Mm-hmm. I was pretty shocked, honestly. I have been reporting this story for, at that point, I don't know how long, but overall I've been reporting the story for about, you know, 2.5 years. And I just find that again and again, there are new things that I come across in my reporting or that I find out or witness that still surprise me. Actually, I just learned something last night that I can't talk about that was really shocking, but that's, you know, to come.
We'll look for it in the future. So tell us a little bit about the reaction to the first story in the series. At first, Mayor de Blasio declined to comment on it, but he sort of turned around later. What was his office's first response?
Mm-hmm. So he publicly said that he believes that everyone should have the right to due process, but that he also thinks that nuisance abatement is an important tool to keep communities safe. His office later clarified that he doesn't think that the NYPD should always refrain from using these ex parte closing orders. You know, it wasn't 100% clear, because the very definition to a lot of people of not having due process is when you're deprived of a right before you have the opportunity to defend yourself in court, which is what the ex parte closing orders do. They close your business or your home before you've had the opportunity to defend yourself and tell your side of the story. So anyway, since then, he's been deferring all questions to the city law department. The city law department had already been tasked with signing every case and signing every settlement. You know, it's almost like they're kind of reviewing their own work. But you know, he hasn't really, you know, said a whole lot more besides that. The law department is reviewing the cases. They've essentially stopped filing them, I recently found, and They also said during a city council hearing that they were going to dramatically reduce their use of these ex parte orders.
I see. So they've made a pledge, basically, but there's not necessarily anything that's going to force them to adhere to it, at least any directive from the mayor's office itself.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the city council is working on a lot of bills. From my understanding, there's a lot of bills in that are being drafted right now, and you can expect to see a package unless something changes. You know, even if the city, the NYPD, and the law department decide that they're going to, you know, change their practices, that doesn't stop it from happening again in the future. Unless there's more, you know, safeguards written into the law, more specificity in the law itself.
How did you shift your focus from apartments to small businesses?
Well, actually, it wasn't really a shift in focus. I had to put together the data on nuisance abatement actions. The way that I did that was there was no unique case type identifier where we could just get nuisance abatement actions, but I searched all cases that were brought by the city of New York, and from there created a spreadsheet of nuisance abatement cases. And some of them were against businesses and some of them were against residences. So we just did the story about the residential cases first and then the business cases second.
And the lead anecdote of the small business story begins with the laundromat owned by a guy named Sung Cho. A Korean guy who had owned a laundromat for many years and found out one day that the police department had issued a restraining order against the facility, and he really had no warning. The way you describe it in the story is he just sort of shows up to work one day and there's this sign across the door. What was it like getting to know him? How did you find him? What's his story?
So one of the advantages of creating your own data from going through cases is that it's a really good way to find examples. And I just remember reading that case, and it says that an undercover police officer went into a laundromat on two separate occasions, sold goods, purportedly stolen iPhones and iPads on two separate occasions to, you know, people that were inside the laundromat. And then, 6 or 7 months later, they filed this nuisance abatement action threatening to shut the laundromat down for a year and to auction off all of its contents. I mean, that was really crazy to me when I read that.
And
I was
bonkers. An undercover officer goes into essentially a public space, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the door's open. Maybe the owner and operator's there. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's watching, you know, surveillance footage. Maybe he's not. And the undercover officer sells something illegal out of the laundromat and then busts the owner for it.
Yeah. And, you know, and saying, you know, the laundromat's a public nuisance, right? So it was like, I definitely have to talk to this guy. So I went to the laundromat. And, you know, first of all, I'll say it was one of the nicest businesses in the neighborhood. I mean, it was like perfectly like spotless, like really nice laundromat. As I was waiting, there was just one woman working. It was a really large laundromat, so I could also see how it'd be very hard to, you know, control what was going on. She was sort of in the area where you fold clothes, which was a set aside from the rest of the laundromat. So she, you know, wasn't even really aware of everything that was going on in the laundromat. You know, she called Sung Cho, and as we were waiting for Sung Cho to arrive, a man came in hawking bootleg DVDs. And, of course, she was totally unaware of it because she was back there folding clothes. So it just kind of shows you how difficult it is to control that kind of activity. And then, actually, as I was interviewing Sung Cho, a man, again, you know, came in behind him hawking DVDs. This was on a different – we came back with a video camera. And like, I don't know if it was the same guy, but, you know, came in hawking DVDs behind Sung Cho as he was talking to me. He did not realize what was happening behind him. So, I mean, it just kind of goes to show you that, you know, it's really difficult for a small business owner to control that activity sometimes.
Right. I mean, it seems like a really aggressive move on the part of the police department and sort of mistargeted. What is the motivation for them to go after someone like Sung Cho?
You know, they say that they're responding to quality of life complaints. When I spoke with the head of the precinct community council in that precinct, he said that there have been complaints about people getting their iPhones stolen, and that businesses like Sung Cho's kind of contribute to that ecosystem because they create a marketplace for the, you know, hawker to come in and sell their stolen wares, was sort of his justification for it. With the alcohol cases, they would say that there's a problem with underage drinking or violent incidences that stem from minors who are drunk. But again, you know, we spoke to some people from those precincts that said that wasn't really a problem. So other reasons, the former attorneys from the Civil Enforcement Unit did say that there was a lot of pressure to keep a high volume of cases. The commander of the unit has to go to a CompStat meeting. So that's sort of a whole different topic. Also spoke with a former lieutenant who said that there was pressure to keep numbers up. It's one of the ways that officers can show that they're being productive and proactive and responding to community concerns. So I think, you know, kind of on both ends.
And so switching the focus back on, you know, for lack of a better word, victims, the majority of them are minorities, mm-hmm. both in the nuisance abatement cases that are applied against folks who are at risk of losing their apartments, and then in your more recent story, people who own and operate small businesses. There was a graphic where you compared alcohol violations in the East Village, which is a primarily white neighborhood, versus East Harlem, which is a primarily minority neighborhood. What'd you find?
With the business cases, there's a heavy concentration of these cases in a few precincts that are also heavily minority. The East Harlem in Manhattan, Wakefield in the Bronx, Inwood also in Manhattan, and then another precinct out in Queens had really high number of these cases in comparison to the other precincts. There were other precincts that had a lot of alcohol cases forwarded to the State Liquor Authority. The State Liquor Authority gets all instances of arrests and summonses for alcohol violations that didn't have a lot of nuisance abatement actions. Some of those precincts were also heavily minority, actually, like Bushwick. But then there were a lot of precincts like East Village, Lower East Side, you know, that are well known as being party havens, a lot of, you know, underage drinking and, you know, debauchery, that didn't really have that many nuisance abatement actions. And so I think that the point of that analysis was just to show that depending on where your business is, you're more likely to suffer, you know, harsher penalties in you know, certain places as opposed to others. Everyone is penalized by the state, but in some precincts, you're also very likely to get penalized for these nuisance abatement actions as well, you know, for the same offense as, you know. So the bodega owner in East Harlem is getting penalized twice, whereas the bar owner in East Village is only getting penalized once by the state.
One of the things that struck me about the bodega story, well, both stories, was that the settlements often involve people allowing police to monitor their homes or stores routinely. Mm-hmm. What's the practical impact of that for a store owner or a resident?
Of course, we asked everyone who had this term in their settlement whether the police were regularly coming back and making good on that term. And a lot of people said that they hadn't come back. And then there were some people that said that they had come back and had searched. But overall, I think that just like the knowledge that the police could come and search their home or their business at any time, people felt very violated by that. One woman said, you know, it really sort of affected her life because she didn't want to have, you know, people over. You know, she just never knew when the NYPD was going to come and conduct a search of her house. So just the idea that it could happen at any moment, any time, you know, had a psychological effect on her and her family.
Final question for you. The evolution of the partnership with ProPublica, it's something that we do here quite a lot. Mm-hmm. We've worked with The Washington Post, The New York Times, LA Times, 60 Minutes, NPR, so on. It's a little unusual in a way that we're partnering with a tabloid in this case, right? So walk us through how that developed.
I was talking with Eric Umansky, the deputy managing editor, and just talking about my story, and he said he was interested in partnering with us on it. And it actually worked out really well for us because there was more research that we wanted to do on the cases. When I first started reporting the story, I was really interested in just seeing how systemic it was for people who hadn't been convicted of a crime to then lose access to their home. But as I then did more reporting, I learned of all of these other aspects of the case that I wanted to go back through the cases and track all these other aspects. That ended up being some of the most impactful data points, actually, of the series. So I think one of the great things that ProPublica was able to do is to provide help with that research, and then also, of course, the great editorial direction as well. So,
great. Well, it was a fantastic project, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very happy to have you on board and glad this worked out. Thanks for coming.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.